Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning. You're very welcome to the show. Before we meet our panel, let's have a look at the front pages. So the Sunday Times is following up on their story last week about the dubious practices in CHI, and they're saying Minister orders a full audit into CHI practices. Jennifer Carl McNeill acts within hours of receiving report alleging that sick children had treatment delayed. They do point out in this story that the minister, and she said this herself, she got the report on Monday. She became aware of this report when she was rung by the Sunday Times for comment on the story in advance of them publishing it last Sunday. The Business Post is leading with DAA and Aer Lingus slam Fingal over nonsense night flight case. Aer Lingus chief warns devastating case more damaging than passenger cap row. The Sunday Independent, housing crisis is deepening under the coalition, public say, and this is suggested in a poll that they have today, and we'll come back to that. The Sunday World is leading on a story about the man who has identified himself as the suspect in the Michael Gain case, that is Michael Kelly. And the Irish Mail on Sunday is in common with actually the Irish Sunday Mirror and the Irish Sun are all leading on the murder of Tina Satchwell and Richard Satchwell, her murderer. Now, our panel this morning, Louise Bayliss from the St. Vincent de Paul is also the co-founder of the single parents organisation Spark. Brenda Power is a columnist with the Irish Daily Mail and the Sunday Times. Larry Donnelly is a law lecturer at the University of Galway, and David W. Higgins is an economist. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, Brendan.
I want to pick a story myself at the start. Brenda, you have a very strong piece in the Sunday Times today, and I think this is something that is weirdly only starting to crystallise for people now, because I suppose people were caught up in the minutiae of the Satchwell case and kind of may not have seen the wood for the trees in a way. But you were writing today that Richard Satchwell murdered Tina Satchwell, but he also then proceeded for years and weeks in this trial to annihilate her all over again. Yes. And her reputation.
Yeah, to traduce the woman that he had murdered and buried under his floor. It seems extraordinary that red flags in this case were not missed early on, were missed so early on. But I mean, what really outraged me about it, listening to this, when it was obvious that he had killed her and buried her, there was no dispute about that. The things he said about her, that she had a vicious temper, she'd assault him at least once a week, that he was often bruised and battered, that she flew at him with a chisel. This woman was 8 stone. And 5'4". She had the size, the build of a child. He was 6'2". Just nothing about it was credible. But the fact that this, that the courts kind of have to indulge this, because of course he is entitled to his defence. But just, you know, on a human level, the fact that this was said about the poor woman when she was not in a position to defend herself, and that this picture of her was allowed to develop over the weeks of this trial, but before that too. And even, you know, his gaslighting appeals to the public when he was pretending she had stolen his money, stolen 26,000, run away, that he portrayed himself as this sort of, you know, servant to this demanding, high-maintenance woman who had finally upped and left him. And, you know, come back, Tina, and I'm not going to be cross. And, you know, everything was designed to sort of create the impression of this violent, controlling, vain woman. He said she's too in love with herself to have killed herself. So I know that hasn't happened. The fact that this went on and we had to listen to this really, to me, compounded the wrong that he did to this woman. He didn't just murder her. He also did his best to destroy her memory for people who loved her.
Yeah, I do think, Louise, that her family have since Friday have reclaimed her memory.
Absolutely.
And reclaimed Tina very much, and I think the public is starting to wake up to that.
Yeah,
as well.
Absolutely. I think some of the lurid details that were shared, that she wanted a bath run every night, this idea that she lay naked on the bed and put body lotion and massaged every night. I mean, there are type of things that intimacy within a married couple or within a couple shouldn't say just married, but within a couple. They're lurid details that should never be made public, and I don't understand the purpose of it. And it was all about just, as Brenda says, about reducing her in the eyes of people, reducing her humanity, and making her out that she was vain, that she was awkward, that she was selfish, that she, I mean, he spoke about when they did their car boot sales, that he would be there doing all the work and she'd be going around spending the money. I mean, he painted a vile picture of somebody that, you know, her family now have the right to have respect for her memory and to recreate that memory again, and to have to listen to somebody you love being pulled apart like that. Really, it's bad that she was killed in life, but as Brenda said, in death she is now, was still violated. And I suppose you can't help but think it's similar in Rape Crisis, where the violence is done and then where people's character is torn apart, you know, a victim's character is done in court. I don't know the answer to it, but there has to be some way of making sure that court isn't another violation or another act of violence towards the victim.
Larry, you picked a piece with Pat Murray. That's in. Did you pick that piece? The piece in the Sunday Endo with Pat Murray.
I didn't.
You wanted to come in on this. Anyway.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think that the family has comported itself with absolute dignity. I think they have reclaimed their Tina in a sense. Look, this individual was obviously entitled to mount his defense as a matter of law. That's a system we have, as Brenda points out in her piece, that we need to have that system. However, the morality of it was so depraved, clearly a vile character, and also a strange individual who evidently was living in a house filthy with dog feces on the ground and different things. Somebody who those who interviewed him on numerous occasions formed the impression that he was at some level basking in the media attention that he was garnering as a result of all this. And at the end of the day, one of the questions I have, and there are lots of questions we have here still, is how come it took so long to undertake this sort of forensic search of the house. I really don't understand why 6 years went by before this was undertaken.
Yeah, the initial search was the warrant for that was not for an invasive search, because I think it was under a missing persons inquiry rather than a murder inquiry. I think it's the technicalities
the
around
was,
that.
You know, alterations in the house. I can understand they went in without the search warrant, but when they saw fresh building work, why was there not an attempt then to change the investigation and to look then and to do an invasive search then, or at least at the very least bring down the dogs and get the search? I mean, that would be the point.
We will say that everybody was presumably doing their best and acting in good faith and everything, but clearly.
But lessons could be learned.
Lessons could absolutely be learned. Very good way of putting it. Brenda, just before we leave it, you were looking at that piece with Pat Murray, who has vast experience in this area.
Well, indeed, he was involved in putting Joe O'Reilly away. So he's making the comparisons there. He said this case was draped with red flags from the outset. He said the first, and again, I think this struck me at the time too, his wife, apparently, this was his story when he went to the police, they'd had a row and she'd left him. So he reported her missing. Why would you do that? He said, well, what he was actually doing, of course, was setting out his stall early on. But most people in those circumstances would have, the last thing they would have done was involve the police. The second thing he said, his second mistake was to court the media. And again, to try to gaslight people with his account of how innocent he was and how wronged he was and what kind of a character she was. And then the third thing was, he said, another trait of a psychopath is they have egos bigger than themselves. He honestly believed that he was pulling the wool over everybody's eyes. But I mean, the fact again that this search wasn't done, I think it's worth mentioning too that it was a team of women basically who put him away. First of all, the senior counsel and junior counsel were both women. I just realised in the Mail has a piece saying that the senior counsel's mother died during the case and she carried on.
Forensic archaeologist.
Again, who was called in by a female police officer and who said, hang on a second, the chances that this woman is in her house are really strong. I was watching actually recently a documentary about the West case and they found the three bodies in his garden. And again, it was a forensic psychologist who said, hang on, the only reason he's using the garden is because the house is full.
Okay,
house.
And we're not drawing a comparison.
Not at all. But at the same time, the suggestion was these people usually bury their victims within a kilometre of where they killed them. So the house should have been searched more thoroughly.
Okay. So we'll move on to, there's a lot of housing in the papers today. David Higgins You picked David Quinn in the Sunday Ender, who was to blame for the housing crisis, every cowardly politician in power.
I did. And it's a strong headline, but there's substance behind it, where David goes into a mix of failures, as he describes them. He describes rent controls as a failure. He talks about the failures now in the water system, and that's covered elsewhere in the papers. Matt Cooper has a great piece on Ishka Éireann and the constraint that we may have in housing supply from that. But he also takes aim at the end of his piece around inward migration and how we've had very strong growth in our population over the years. And that's not just a feature in Ireland. It's been true in the UK and Canada and elsewhere. But leaders, particularly centre-left leaders in those countries, are now beginning to talk for the need of actually managing their inward migration flows. And we're nearly there in Ireland on that discussion, but we're not there yet. Our level of work permits, for example, where we bringing workers.
Yeah, no, he's just to be very clear, he's not talking about the IPAS system or the refugee system or anything else.
Yes.
He is talking about economic migration here and people that we do let into the country to do specific jobs, etc.
Exactly. Yes. And that's the numbers involved in that flow of people are many multiples of the numbers who come in as asylum seekers. And finding a way to manage that. The suggestion I've made in this debate is that the level of salaries needs to go up, because what typically happens is for sectors of the economy like construction, like healthcare assistance, they're relatively low salaries, so it's easy to hire abroad and it's attractive for the firms to do so. But if we were to raise the cost to firms of actually doing that, it might discourage firms from doing that. And the downward effect of that would be that it might ease the pressure.
Raise
the
cost of firms to do it by the state mandating the salaries in these areas?
Well, yeah, so that happens anyway. So anyone who wants to bring in someone via a work permit, there are minimum salary levels. It has been on the agenda for the government to raise those salary thresholds this year, but because of lobbying by employers, it didn't happen. And my call to, particularly to, this is kind of the realm of the Minister for Enterprise, is that that raise in salary threshold should happen.
Okay. On the broader housing picture, Louise, you picked the front page of the Sunday Independent. So this is connected with a poll in the Sunday Independent. But basically, the headline is, housing crisis is deepening under the coalition, public say, and that is suggesting. But I think what that probably means in reality is the narrative around housing has got worse in the last few months, yeah?
The narrative has got worse, but the reality has gotten worse as well. Like, what we're seeing is, you know, a predicted increase of 36,000 houses this year, according to the SRI, yet what is in the Housing for All strategy is 50,000. 50,000 we would consider too low anyway. So the targets would need to be adjusted upwards. But if we're not even reaching the targets that are set too low, I know next month there is going to be a new strategy that comes out. But if we look at even just the most egregious form of the housing crisis, which is homelessness, 30% of the people in emergency accommodation today are children. I mean, I just think that's outrageous and we need to say it more. 30% of everybody in emergency accommodation are children. There's now 4,775 children in emergency accommodation. And that's not including children in domestic abuse refuges, in IPAS system, or children who are staying in a box room in their grandparents' house because their parents haven't got it. But it's 4,775. We have seen, just even in this year alone, we've seen an increase of 11.21% of homelessness, an increase of 11.21%. Among lone parents, it's actually 18%. 18%.
18% overall?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, 18% increase on their homeless.
Sorry.
Yeah,
okay,
18%
right.
In their increases.
So it's up by a fifth.
Yeah, well, just for instance, if we look on year on year on the housing, on the homeless figures, there would have been 249 increase in families in emergency accommodation in the last 12 months, 249. Out of that 249, 196 are lone parent households.
Okay.
We have a strategy that doesn't mention families. The Housing for All strategy does not mention families. family homelessness, because it was written in September 2022, which, as you will remember, there was an eviction ban in place. There were measures, emergency measures, to get people out of their, out of emergency accommodation in their own door. Homelessness for the first time in over a decade was going down. Since the strategy has been written, we see family homelessness going up much higher than single adult homelessness. There's no strategy. There is strategy for single adults, which is Housing First, which is needed, and I wouldn't stop it. But we need family homelessness strategy, and specifically around lone parent issues.
OK, so just to give people the detail on that poll. So the latest Sunday Independent Ireland Thinks poll published today, it says in that front page story by Gabby Agata-Vetskaita, shows 61% of the public believe the issue has become worse in the lifetime of the coalition. Only 3% believe there has been any improvement in housing. 34% feel it has stayed the same. So this was a text-based poll conducted on Wednesday and Thursday, May 29th and 30th. Changes indicated since May 4th poll. And the sample size was 1,857 people, and the margin of error was plus or minus 2.3%. Larry, you picked that piece as well.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I mean, much in the polling on that, and it shows that people have had enough. And I think Shane Coleman, writing in the Business Post, he neatly and succinctly delineates all the problems like developers won't build because it's not economically viable, banks won't lend, approved housing bodies can't get the money fast enough from government, water projects. NIMBYism, all sorts of other things, a fast growing population. He points out all of the, the individual problems. But at the same time, you know, the public are saying that it's just not good enough. And as Owen O'Malley writes, you know, look, it's you know, it's time for radical solutions and not drift. And what we've had is a sustained period of drift.
The verdict on Friday in the High Court.
And that's just not good enough.
A good day for Gerry Adams, but a bad day for
journalists. John Drennan writing about a minister who says if what we do isn't radical, then the crisis will not melt away. The fact he said it already is, and I would correct that to say it already has.
The practice of
the fact is that people have lost faith completely, and we'll see what this means politically.
Can I just say really quickly, just on that, I would, you know,
in terms of journalism in Northern Ireland,
far be it for me to defend the government here, but I am going to say that it is only 6 months
outside the court.
And I will say one thing that's different about this minister for housing.
That he took the case
really
to put manners on the BBC,
now, whether we'll see that
which he said was out of sync
know,
with the Good Friday Agreement.
Well,
what did you
chance?
Take that to
I
mean?
I will say that he's
well,
gone around
that
over the last
chilling
few
comment, actually,
he has
and
met
it suggested
with
an
you know, from
the
builders to developers to financiers to housing organisations to homeless organisations to charities. He is doing the groundwork. Whether that we'll see that with results, but I will say at least he is consulting before he makes a plan, but that plan has to be radical.
Brenda.
And yet the Mail has a piece today saying that his authority has been seriously undermined by the whole Housing SAR episode, whereby the General Secretary of the Department came out on Friday and said, we do not need a Housing SAR. Can I be clear on this? Once and for all, there's a sense that in some quarters that if you knock a few heads together, if you give enough people a kick in the backside, things will happen. I only wish this was the case. Now, he subsequently retracted that and said, what I was objecting to was the use of the word Housing SAR.
The Department said that that's what he was objecting
but
to.
But it is clearly a reference, or at least I would say it is a reference to the minister saying, we need someone to kick down doors. We need boots on the ground. So the John Drennan's piece is, again, he says, you know, if this had happened under Charlie McCreevy's watch, you know, that person probably would have had been spoken to, I think. I also picked David Quinn's piece, Brendan, because he among the I suppose the elements of this narrative that have emerged over the last while relates to how to water. I think it was Ger Howland writing in the Indo last week said something similar, that had we stuck with housing charges and not caved
water
into political
charges.
Pressure, or water charges and not caved into political pressure, that we wouldn't be in the situation where Ishka Aaron is saying we can only supply water to 35.
That's the budget they were given because they were the housing targets at the time as well. And they are saying, no, if you want us to connect 50,000 houses,
we don't have the
money. You need to give us a bigger budget.
We don't have the money.
Yeah.
This is in the. So Matt Cooper has a great piece on this. And what he describes is that Ishka Aaron is only given an annual budget, whereas in other organisations, you might get a multi-annual budget. So that could be something that gives Ishka Aaron a bit of certainty, gives them, you know, kind of more runway to work with to go off and do some bigger projects. But not only will they need to get a multi-annual budget, there need to be higher numbers in that budget too.
Louise, you don't mind telling me about your son who's impacted by the housing crisis?
No, not at all. Yeah. So my son got his degree, started working, was working full time, is working full time.
And so he did everything he was supposed to do under the social contract,
exactly,
etc. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. He did everything right. He did his leaving cert, got enough points, got the first choice course he wanted, did really well in his degree, got a job, literally signed the contract before his degree was finished, went straight, not even one day, not working, went straight into his job. Had his car and could not move out of the house. Like, you know, on his salary as it was live with mammy and have a car, which he needed to get to work, or move out and not have any life, like literally have no social life. And he decided with his girlfriend at the time to, well, I'm just going to have to leave the country. He left the country, moved over to Malta, and about a month ago, he bought his first house in Malta, which is great for him, but heartbreaking for me.
Of course.
Yeah. Yeah. Listen, I was wondering, was it just in my ear, or if that was going out on air, there was a kind of a technical problem of stuff coming in there for a minute, so I can never be sure if that's going out on air or not, but it was certainly in my ear. But very sorry about that, and I think we have resolved it now, so we will double down. You're all blissfully unaware of it, don't worry. But the rest of the country and myself, I think we're in on that one.
But you had Bono on last week saying that his son couldn't afford to move out of his house, or at least none of the other members of Inhaler could afford to move out of
his house. Well, my son definitely couldn't.
No, listen, I think the point there was probably that they weren't hugely motivated to move out of the house, might have been it. There's also interesting stuff in this poll, Larry, and Kevin Cunningham it alludes to it in his piece. He's the pollster. War in Gaza has moved from a peripheral issue to a top concern, he's saying.
Yeah, and you know, 86% of those asked said that what is going on is a genocide or amounts to a genocide, and it's clearly...
Do you believe it is a genocide at this stage?
Look, there are scholars who take different views. I'm not a genocide scholar, but it's kind of hard to look past what we see on a daily basis and draw any other conclusions. The interesting point is that what we see in terms of support for the Occupied Territories Bill, which is overwhelming. It's 74%. But it is down off that number of 86%, which is an interesting dissonance and suggests that perhaps for some people, they are concerned about what the ramifications might be for this country and its people if the Occupied Territories Bill is enacted. And maybe to put some clarification on that, for instance, there are...
Yeah, but hang on. There's only 16%, this poll suggests, who are against the Occupied Territories Bill. 10% don't know. And then 75%, three quarters of people. So the vast majority I think we should affect the
Occupied Territories. And I'm not questioning that. I'm just saying, you mentioned the people who are uncertain. And to some extent, I would put myself in that category because of, again, the stats I'm going to give you now, which is that 38 states in the United States have so-called anti-BDS laws, which effectively make it difficult to do business with persons organizations or indeed governments who have boycotts of any kind going on against Israel. A bill to do that at federal level is pending. And that is dangerous, again, because we are exposed, because this is a Trump administration. As I said on this program before, the moves in Ireland, the sentiment in Ireland, the diplomatic relations breakdown did not go unnoticed. And when you couple that backdrop against, and so we are exposed in that front, when you couple that against the fact that while it would be an important signal to send, no question about it, in terms of actual impact on the horrendous things that we are seeing unfold every day, and Nisha Dolan's writing about this in the Sunday Indo, and I don't disagree with her assessment of any of that, but what I'm saying is that there may be a very real tangible cost in this, and that's why at a certain level I have sympathy for the government, because the government's responsibility, primary, first and foremost, is to preserve the safety, the lives and the livelihoods of the people of this country.
Yeah, but is it not clear now that a lot of people in Ireland are extremely exercised about this and believe that there is a moral choice to be made here, that we cannot look away, and that even if these things are just symbols, that we should be seen to stand on the right side of history in the light of what we are seeing going on
there. There's absolute intellectual coherence to that point. There is absolute moral clarity to that point. There is no doubt about it. But the fact is, there are potential consequences, and that's where things get a little bit more tricky than that.
Would you go on the side of a moral stance here, or Larry's kind of realism?
I think a moral stance. I would have to go with a moral stance, and I understand the economic impact. I think just looking at some of the pictures came out last week, you know, the little 5-year-old girl who lost, you know, it's just so distressing.
The little five-year-old,
yeah, who walked out. I mean, you couldn't, if you asked AI to create an image that shows hell, that would be it. A little 5-year-old girl making her way out of the fire, and to explain how she walked over the dead bodies of her sister and her mother. And, you know, this child lost five siblings and a mother. Then you have the story of the woman, the pediatrician, who lost 9 of her children while she's working
Ten
in a
children,
hospital.
Yeah.
9 of her Ten. Children and her son and husband in hospital. You hear that and you have to say, it may not make a difference to the war, but it does make, I think we need to reclaim our power in whatever way we can. And if reclaiming our power is saying, I am not going to stand by with people who are doing these things, I will not support it, I will make this stand, I think it's important we do it. It isn't going to have a massive impact on whether the war stops or not, but it will make a difference to us to say we did all we could in our power, and
David,
history will judge
think?
On
because,
us.
Because I suppose every country makes their own decisions on these things, and the whole picture is just a conglomeration of lots of individual decisions that might not seem that important on their own. But I guess if everybody starts making those kinds of decisions, it does put pressure, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, look, even without changing any law, people have their own decisions they make with investment and trade. And I would bet that anyone out there, if 86% of the country believe that this is a genocide, anyone involved in business will think again about doing business in Israel from here on. But the question about reclaiming power, as you rightly say, Louise, Ireland had a recent win, I think, 2 weeks ago on this at the European level, where convincing the Dutch and other countries to come on side of review of the EU trade deal was a major success. And it spoke volumes that it's the type of move that Israel actually listens to when a bloc like the EU27 makes a move. The Occupied Territories Bill is Ireland going it alone. And Larry mentions the risks with that. There is also the risk that this may not turn out to be EU compliant, because it is, trade is an EU competency. But there's also the issue, I think, of consistency. So if...
No, has it not been cleared that this bill would be legal, that we could do it?
Well,
in the form that the government is proposing it. They seem to feel they can.
I think that they believe they can. There's always the risk that advice has proven to be wrong, and that they end up in a confrontation with Brussels at a time when our relationship with Brussels on trade needs to be really tight when it comes to the trade war that we're also trying to fight at this time. There's also the issue of consistency, that the idea behind the Occupied Territories Bill is noble in that it's not just about Gaza. It's not even in the title. It's about all occupied territory. So you could expand it to other conflicts around the world. But what if, for example, Taiwan becomes under the realm of China again, and suddenly 90% of the world's advanced semiconductors are in an occupied territory? Do we take that consistent view and say we're going to put Taiwan under that legislation
as well?
Yeah, you
see, I don't think people are thinking about consistency or what if at the moment. I'm not saying that's right or wrong.
Yeah,
I think
yeah.
people are just like, they're in a moment here and mm-hmm. they are, feel it's a moment in history.
Yes.
Larry, are you clear in any way as to... like watching last night now and watching some very eminent commentators like Aaron David Mitchell, and watching former... Israeli negotiators and stuff like that, all of them appear to be saying that, you know, whatever putative deal is on the table this weekend, Israel doesn't want to end this, and actually Hamas does not want to end it either, because either of them ends it, it's existential for them. They are finished. Furthermore, are we in a situation as well where Hamas is so degraded now that they're actually, it seems to have no control over Gaza anyway? I gather there are 18 factions controlling various neighbourhoods and this and that over there. So, like, there's no easy way out of this, is there?
Absolutely not. I mean, it appears increasingly to be an intractable situation. And all the while, you know, what the others have alluded to, these horrific, horrific deaths of innocent men, women, and children are going to continue. And we don't see a way out. And of course, President Trump maintained that he was going to end this very quickly. And, you know, that seems to have gone away. And I think that he probably is annoyed with both sides. But however, American political realities dictate a certain posture, and that's horrendous. But that's where we're at. So I just don't see how we get any resolution when there is, especially on the part of Benjamin Netanyahu, such malice and evil at the heart of all of it.
Brenda.
Yeah, I know. I agree with Larry. I mean, I think that it is looking increasingly intractable. The current ceasefire proposals on the table, which Israel has accepted, have been rejected by Hamas. Among other arguments that they're making is that it won't give them control of humanitarian aid. And of course, and there's a suspicion that the reason they want control of that is that they can loot it and sell it. But they, as you say,
equally, a lot of reputable agencies say that that is not happening and that they were getting aid to people where they needed it on the ground, and that this new system of aid.
This is the
humanitarian fund. I mean, sure, didn't we see again last night that a load of people gone down by the Israelis around one of those centres?
Yeah, no, I don't see how this is going to be resolved in the short term, because as Larry said, it is an existential position for both sides at this stage. And if Hamas have been as degraded, and I think that another Hamas leader was killed over the last 24 hours, that they're going to fight to the death to hang on to what they have. And I mean, one of the suggestion was that they would free, was it 28 hostages in return for something like 1,200 Palestinian prisoners. Prisoners, and some of those hostages are dead. Some of the hostages are dead. So I mean, it's there's humanitarian sort of issues on both sides,
yes.
And we'd be reluctant to do anything that would give any comfort to Hamas too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the most disturbing things about all of this is the weight being placed on Israeli lives versus the weight being placed on Palestinian lives, and I think that is horrific. Humanitarian tragedy at all levels. And again, I would hold the United States, and it gives me no pleasure to say it, the United States in successive administrations to blame for a lot of that.
Okay, we'll take a break. Louise Bayliss, Brenda Power, Larry Donnelly and David W. Higgins staying with us. Welcome back. Louise Bayliss, Brenda Power, Larry Donnelly and David W. Higgins are still with us. Larry Donnelly, obviously, we saw Elon retire temporarily or permanently from Doge and from the administration during the week. You picked two pieces today, one in the Sunday Times, Musk got the keys to the White House, he's sure to let himself back in, and the Mail on Sunday, the inside story of how Elon went to Washington to drain the swamp. So tell us what's interesting about the story it stands now.
The piece in the Sunday Times is interesting because it suggests strongly that this is only a temporary separation between Musk and President Trump. I'm not 100% sure about
they
that.
They were very warm now on Friday, it has to be said, but was it fakey warm or...?
Could well have been. I mean, these are two guys who it's impossible to predict their next move. And indeed, we've read some deeply disturbing things about allegations relating to Elon Musk's drug use and prolific drug use, allegedly. So again, that's another wild card to put in this entire situation. I'm not so sure that Musk gets back with Trump because I think Musk has been critical recently of Trump, critical in particular about his big, beautiful bill and saying it could be big but mightn't be beautiful and other things. And he's clearly Doge and misapprehensions about Doge, and he didn't get to do the job, I guess, and all sorts of other things. Trump, I don't think, is going to take very kindly to that. So we'll see where it goes. On a conflicting note,
Could Elon Musk end up being an antagonist of Trump?
He could well. He could well. I mean, we don't know what's going to happen. What I think militates possibly against that is he gave Republicans hundreds of millions the last election cycle. A lot of Republicans are going to say, we need Elon's cash, so get cozy with them.
Yeah, even though Elon has signaled that maybe I've given enough money to politics for now.
I think he's kind of saying, look, I'm getting back to business. My sojourn in politics is over. But again, it's very unpredictable. And if he gets the idea that he can exert power, maybe he will. But against that, again, he's lost out a lot of money on Tesla. Tesla has dived across the board because of his association with Donald Trump. The other piece you mentioned, and again, this is reflective of so much much of the mindset within the Trump administration. One administration source, what he said about Elon Musk is just another ungrateful immigrant. And I thought that that was a staggering thing to say.
Yeah, okay. Brenda, you picked Declan Lynch, it has to be said, was early on this one and has been very consistent on Trump, MAGA, the whole thing. And he's got a good spin on it today, 10 steps on Elon Musk's journey to the dark side.
Yes, how the offboarding basically came about.
Yeah.
So he goes through the steps, the brand, the mistake, the tweeting. The Doge particularly, he said Trump with his reptilian cunning rewarded Elon with the role of slasher-in-chief wielding the chainsaw of Doge, figuratively and literally, of course, because he came out with that rhinestone-studded chainsaw. He said with his lack of self-awareness, Elon couldn't comprehend how grotesque it looked for someone so rich and famous to be demolishing the lives of the poor and unknown. And worse still, to be assisted by incels with names like Big Balls and Katie Balls makes reference to the same sort of, I suppose, vulnerability that Musk had really in circumstances where he wants to be liked, and that he was like a deer in the headlights when he was booed at Dave Chappelle's comedy show in San Francisco. He really didn't understand that this would impact so negatively on his
that the richest man
reputation.
In the world is wrong firing
people
poor
people. Didn't love him for this.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Does the richest man in the world ever be liked by the general public?
I don't think he was entitled to be.
The one thing we're kind of missing from the Trump story so far in his presidency is a "you're fired" moment. Musk has kind of quietly come to the sidelines and supposedly, you know, still has a key to the White House. He wants to come back. But you mentioned, Larry, about being an antagonist. The most common trend of the first Trump term was that people would get fired they'd leave, and then they would become opponents, thinking of Mike Pence then after Trump was in office. We're not seeing that. That's partly because Trump has largely put yes men around him this time. So it's going to be a while maybe until we get the "you're fired" moment.
Yeah. Louise, you were looking at those Musk pieces as well.
Yeah, the one thing I thought that really struck me was when we're saying, will he go into a rival? If he does, it would be very detrimental, because he's not like a normal rival in that he controls X. He also controls the biggest media platform in the US. So you can't really go battle with them, because we all know the media, the narrative, it's all led. They decide the algorithms, especially now. And I don't see how the Republican Party could go against Musk without suffering massive losses.
Yeah, so you see, you're touching on, I do sometimes like in the daydream and think, wouldn't it be great if Musk used his powers for good?
Will it ever happen?
Yeah. Come here, Larry, there's a great piece. I don't think I've been paying enough attention to Steve Witkoff. There's a great piece by Louise O'Callaghan in the Sunday Times, kind of painting a picture of this guy around on his own on a plane going around the world, paying a plane he's paying for himself with no aides and maybe not connected that much to the actual administration, suggesting crazy deals to everyone.
Yeah, it's absolutely extraordinary. And I'm somebody who doesn't necessarily dismiss doing things unconventionally out of hand. For instance, if we look at the George W. Bush presidency, everything was conventional. It was all the old experienced hands. And look at the evil they wrought around the world. So I'm not necessarily opposed to unconventional, but this is bonkers. Steve Witkoff is evidently going into meetings in the Kremlin by himself and relying on
Putin.
Yeah, and relying on a Kremlin interpreter to do everything for him. I mean, you couldn't make it up. And then side by side, his son is having meetings with the same leaders selling cryptocurrency from a firm that's co-owned by his family and the Trump empire. I mean, you really, really couldn't make it up. And let's not forget, evidently, the start of this friendship was they bumped into each other and Witkoff bought Trump a ham sandwich and thereby earned his loyalty for life.
Okay. Of course, this is great fun and games, David, but we're still very conscious that this could all upend our world at any minute, depending on his mood. Like I was wondering if he put up the steel tariffs to 50% the other day just because he was standing in front of steel workers at the time. Like, I mean, it's at that level. So in terms of effects on us... Did you want to mention the med tech piece? I think a lot of people aren't aware of how important med tech is in this country.
Yeah, this is a piece, Sarah Collins in the Sunday Business Post, and she just talks about the med tech sector pleading with the EU, because the EU has made a list of tariff items that it will do retaliation on if the talks fail, right? These things are kind of hypothetical lists. You publish the list, you say, hey, we might tariff you on this, and it kind of puts pressure on the other side. But there's 577 items relating to medtech that are actually on this list. So individual different types of product and different product lines. I mean, I couldn't even begin to explain what those are. I mean, all the different devices you might see in a typical hospital would be the type of stuff it includes. But there's 50,000 people in Ireland who work in medtech. It's 8% of exports out of Ireland. And I think a lot of the focus has been on pharmaceuticals up until now. And medtech has probably been lost a bit in the background. But they are very much pleading with the EU not to be on that list. And we're really at the behest of Trump and von der Leyen to go off and negotiate something, and then we'll know whether this list actually gets activated.
And the ESRI came out with a report that showed jobs, employment will drop by 3% if these tariffs were introduced.
3% of jobs that won't be created.
We
have to make that caveat. So are you hopeful of some kind of a deal that isn't too damaging to us, David?
I think that, like, so when Trump came out and announced his 50% tariff on the EU, I remember the first week when the Liberation Day stuff came out, you had bank stocks and other EU stocks pretty much tanking across the board. Trump comes out and says 50% and markets don't move at all. And that's, I think, a sign that they moved a little bit, but it's a sign that Trump's words on this are very much an opening salvo. And then we get to talk, and then we find out what the final number is by the end of it. But we are continually pushing back deadlines on this.
Yeah, but are we even listening to the markets anymore? Like, they're like a reactive teenager at this stage. Like, you know what I mean? I think being guided by the wisdom of the markets, I'm starting to wonder about. We'll move on. Brendy, you want to talk about an interesting story in the Mail on Sunday. And now we'll be careful around this because it is kind of slightly complicated. But the story is that Gloucester was warned about NTPF, that's the National Treatment Purchase Fund, abuse. This is in the context of the story in the Sunday Times last week about the one doctor anyway who was pushing his patients into his private clinic and it was being paid for by the National Treatment Purchase Fund. This is not what Bernard Gloucester was specifically warned about by this whistleblower here who said that they had suspicions about use of the NTPF.
It's general suspicions, it seems, that the NTPF was open to abuse or was capable of being abused. And of course, you know, I think the point John Mooney was making in last Sunday's piece was it did rely to a huge extent on trust, you know, because the whole idea of the NTPF, which was very well-intentioned and is, has I'm sure, been a great boon to a lot of people on long waiting lists, was that if the waiting list was so long and the treatment was urgent, that the treatment would be bought for you privately by the government. And that's very worthy. But I suppose the potential for abuse was always there in that, as is the allegation in this particular case, that a consultant saw the opportunity to hive these patients off into his own private clinic.
Are you suggesting he might not have been the only one in the whole country?
I mean, it's hard to believe that he was.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think that's why the Sunday Times lead story today is that Jennifer Carol McNeill has now ordered an audit of this, of the, well, it's CHI, but I mean, across the board, this wasn't just children that this facility was available to, that this treatment purchase fund was available to. So the question has to be asked, has it happened anywhere else? The Mail quotes one statistic, one particular procedure, for instance, HSE staff were paid €10 a piece for doing it. But if they did it privately at the weekends in out-of-hours clinic, it was €200.
This is for a scan.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to believe that there's only one person has spotted that potential.
Yeah, and so they this whistleblower's allegation, I think it was last year, and a spokeswoman did say 2023, that the CEO engages with people who raise concerns about the HSE directly with them and delegates to the most appropriate staff member for further action where warranted. And it kind of says that the whistleblower didn't get a response, but did seem to have got a response saying, I've noted the concerns and wish to inquire into them further. Louise, you were a whistleblower.
I was, yeah. And that's why this article really upset me, because when you make that decision to reveal something, you are making a very, you are aware of the risk. Now, by the sounds of the story, this person wasn't at risk. But for me, it was a very, it was a really emotional time in my life when I had to make the choice. And it was in relation to Grange Gorman, where I saw the mistreatment, or I would allege,
a psychiatric hospital,
and I would allege mistreatment of women patients in the hospital. And I was very upset when I saw it. I raised it with line managers, and I was told it'll be sent into the Mental Health Commission, but the practice was going to continue. And I was really upset, and I came home from work that day and, you know, managed to put kids to bed. And then when I sat down in the house that evening, floods of tears coming, thinking, and it was because of the conflict I felt, because I thought, one hand, I cannot see these women being treated this way and not do anything. But when you, I was a mother on my own with two children, I cannot put our, their financial security at risk because of my morality. And just by chance, my son came down the stairs, saw me crying, asked what's going on, and I explained. I tried to brush it off, and he was like, no, just please tell me, because I'm going to worry otherwise. And I told him, and he said, ma'am, are you honestly going to tell me you'd put money before helping those women? And to me, that gave me permission to do what was right. But I paid a heavy price for it. Now, I lost my job. Then I was reinstated on a different contract. And it was a temporary contract that when the fixed term was over, it wasn't renewed. And I found it really hard to get another job, and certainly not in the area I was working in. And as a result of that, I was about 3 or 4 years with not earning anything and very close to losing my home. I mean, very close, to the extent that the lender contacted me and they said, we will pay you 6 months' rent if you surrender your home. That's how close I was to losing my home. So I know the emotional turmoil that you are putting yourself and your whole family in. And then to think, when you've done that decision, not everybody's going to go through what I went through, but if you have made that decision, you are accepting a risk that this could happen to you. And when you accept that, and then you see that it's, we've noted our concerns, that really got to me, because if somebody's made that real commitment to try to improve things, they deserve to be heard.
Yeah, okay. And look, as far as we know, the person was heard, and we don't know what happened subsequently about that, just to be fair to everyone involved in this. Okay, we'll take a break. Louise Bayliss, Brenda Power, Larry Donnelly and David Higgins staying with us. Welcome back. Our panel's still here. Louise Bayliss, Brenda Power, Larry Donnelly and David Higgins. Brenda, Peter Allen in the Sunday Indo, Inside the Macron Marriage. So come on, give us your
Le Slapgate,
as
it's been called. Yeah, I think there's very few people now who haven't seen the footage of the Macrons descending from the plane in those famous few seconds of clarity, I suppose. She definitely gave him a push in the gob, whatever was going on behind in advance. The Elite Palace first tried to say that this was fake news and this was deep fake, and then they had to admit that no, it was just a bit of horseplay, or they were bickering, or they were having a laugh. I mean, it's hard to really know what was going on, but I suppose there are very few couples, Brendan, I would say, who have been together for 30 years, as this couple have, who will be able to say that every single physical contact between them was loving and affectionate. That's not to justify it in any way, but it I suppose they have an unconventional marriage, let's put it that way. There is a 24-year age gap between them. She was his teacher, she's 72 and he's 49.
Yeah, does that help the argument that this is all harmless horseplay, or does it actually make it kind of worse?
I think it makes it worse. The dynamic that she was his teacher, she was in a position of authority, and now we see her physically pushing him. I think that makes it a lot worse, Brenda.
I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying it makes it worse or better, but they have a very unconventional marriage. They have a relationship that would be unusual for most people.
Even for France.
Well, even for France.
Well, this is it. So it's unconventional for Macron to have gone through a first term and part of a second term without a significant love life story, because actually it's par for the course through the French presidency over many decades that there is some sort of story, scandal. So this was in fact overdue, possibly.
Well, he has been fighting rumours of homosexuality. I think he's had to come out and say that he wasn't having an affair with his bodyguard.
When you say he's had to come out,
he has to come out.
The thing is, Louise, It's domestic violence.
That's the. That's what I don't like. I know what you're saying, Brent, about physical contact, but to me that was a physical shove. And yes, it would be, you know, if a man did that to a woman, we would be frontline news. I don't understand the laughter of it. You know, we know there are men abused. Maybe it's definitely not to the
but
same extent as women.
Would it be much more serious if a man had done it?
It would have been,
woman.
But it's still violence is violence, and I just think there should be a zero tolerance, and it should be for men and women. Now I know it's much more prevalent, but we wouldn't make jokes about it, and I don't see anything funny about it. I personally—they're
kind of making a joke.
Yeah,
about
they,
it, though,
exactly.
They
are. But I mean, like, to me, again, I just think the whole dynamics of she was his teacher, and looking at his face—if anybody sees the shocked look on his face and his quick recovery—he was like a little boy being given out.
But was he shocked because it was seen, or was, no, was he shocked because it happened? We don't
you
know.
See, he's shocked when he got the push, and then it kind of.
He's clearly shocked and recovers quickly because he's been seen.
Yeah, but he was shocked as well when he was pushed. You can see that. And then the recovery when he saw the doors opening. But I think, to be honest, he looked like a little schoolboy being admonished by a teacher. And that is the dynamic. Like, I don't know the dynamics in the relationship, but it was. He was a pupil and she was his teacher. And you're seeing that replicated in front of us.
Her son was in his class.
Yeah.
That's right.
He was
younger than him, I think. Yeah. Or older than him.
No, he was into his 20s before they got married. But I think before his parents sent him off to school to get him out of harm's way, he did promise her as a teenager, like, I will be back and I will marry you. And she was...
He was 29 when they married and she was 54.
And the relationship started when he was 15.
Yeah. Larry, you're making faces there. Come on, out with it.
Yeah. You know, look, we call this their relationship now unconventional, and I think that's a fair way of describing it. And I think Louise's points are very well made. But I wouldn't describe their origin story as unconventional. I'd describe it as troubling.
Yes.
And Jennifer O'Connell made this point writing in the Irish Times yesterday. We'd be having a different conversation if the genders were reversed in this situation, if it was a man at 40 and a woman.
We would say if this was a relationship. Now, they say nothing unhealthy, as I think is the word they use, happened when he was a teenager. But we would say in any other situation, we would say that person was not emotionally mature enough to make decisions about things like this, and that it was grooming and abuse.
Absolutely, 100%.
I'm not saying in this case it is,
that's inescapable. That's
even
absolutely
if the person
true.
Thought they were willingly in this relationship.
Yeah.
Absolutely, that's a fact.
Yeah. Okay.
But I think it's a little bit glib to say, oh, if this was the other way around, you know, we'd be looking at it differently. Of course we would. Because, you know, whether you like it or not, men are physically stronger and more aggressive than women. And if he had been photographed pushing his 72-year-old wife, he would not be in power today.
Yeah.
And for good reason.
Yeah. And the teacher relationship would be different as well, given that in more often than not, it's men who initiate relationships.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. Briefly, just before we go, David, the Mail on Sunday, our own presidency, a much more wholesome activity.
I know.
Mary Hanafin versus Cynthia Ní Bhfiorúcú for Fianna Fáil now.
Yeah, it's John Lee in the paper, and it could be Mary Hanafin or Cynthia Ní Bhfiorúcú for the Fianna Fáil nomination. And look, we'll have to just wait and see. I do think we've actually had a bit of a quiet presidential discussion so far. It's probably going to heat up big time then over the summer, because the clock will be ticking to the autumn when the campaign proper will get underway. These candidates will have to be chosen by their parties. It's all going to come quite quick, I think. Probably when the doll goes in recess, it'll all light up.
Okay. We look forward to it. Thank you very much to my excellent panel this morning, Louise Bayliss, Brenda Power, Larry Donnelly and David W. Higgins. And now it's just after 12 noon and we'll go to the newsroom and Kate Egan.